Welcome to Dialogue Across Difference, an event series hosted by the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Join us as Center Director Larry Jacobs and guests engage in conversations across the political and policy spectrum on issues of the day.
Good afternoon. I'm Professor Larry Jacobs. I direct the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. School of Public Affairs, University of Minnesota. We are the sponsor of today's conversation. Before we begin, just want to let you know that we count on you participating. This is a big part of our conversation today. You'll see at the bottom of the screen, there's a Q&A button. Click on that. Give us your questions. And we'll get to as many as possible. You'll also see just to the right of that, there's a live transcript feature there if you'd like to click on that, and we can provide a in-time transcript for you. Welcome, and thank you for joining our program today, a first look at the 2024 elections. Our guests are Rebecca Piercy, who was the political director for Elizabeth Warren's presidential campaign. She's currently vice president of public affairs for the Bryson Gillette Group. They're involved in local, state, national political campaigns. Also want to welcome Kirsten Kukowski, who was the communications director for the National Republican Party, as well as for Scott Walker's presidential campaign in 2015. She is now working with Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley. Ms. Kukowski is the president of the women-owned and operated public relations firm K2 and Company. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So last night was kind of a big deal. We had elections all over the country, obviously more legislative state races, not national. Let me start with you, Ms. Piercy. What do you make of it, the results?
You know, it feels good to be a Democrat today. It feels just as good as it did bad when we saw the Siena New York Times polls a week ago. So feelings are fleeting in this environment where it's sort of a 24-hour news cycle. But, you know, we're still a year out. I think that the victories from last night signify an enthused electorate for particular issues, particularly abortion and marijuana in Ohio. But, you know, the victories in places like Kentucky and Virginia also show to me that down ballot races matter and the quality of the candidates matter when you're looking at statewide races. So I feel good, but, you know, Sunday could happen and I could feel bad again. And I think that will continue to happen for the next 52 weeks.
Ms. Kukowski, what surprised you most about the results yesterday?
Oh, it surprised me the most. You know, I not much actually. I'm actually working on a U.S. Senate race in Virginia right now, and I think we had kind of seen that what Governor Youngkin was trying to do probably wasn't going to play out. I think leading with the abortion issue, I think, was probably a mistake. I think that there's going to be a lot written about that or talked about on that over the next couple of days and weeks, and so not much. I think, you know, for me, I'm kind of dovetailing off of what Rebecca was just saying, you know, in terms of what this means for next year, I think that it's Republicans better figure out the abortion issue and candidates better start figuring out how they're going to talk about it because it's not going away. So that would be kind of the single takeaway I had is I'm not sure, you know, because this off-year election is probably, like Rebecca kind of insinuated, it's an issue-based election. I would say my biggest takeaway was just the abortion issue and Republicans better figure that out pretty quickly.
And Youngkin, his position was to be in support of a 15-week ban, a ban on abortion after 15 weeks with protections of rape, incest, and the health of the mother. There are a lot of Republicans who are circling around, you know, differences in a number of weeks and how you define it. But there seems to be kind of a coalescence among Republicans on that issue. Are you thinking there's a different way to frame it or just stay away from it?
I think that's a couple things. I think that if I were, you know, if I were working with Governor Youngkin's folks, I think probably doing what he had done, you know, to get elected, which was education, economy, I think probably would have been the leading issues I would have chosen. Specifically to abortion, I think that this whole thing about number of weeks is the wrong playing field. I think right now we're this number of weeks is not a winner. I think where this is right now, where this is headed is, and I think this is indicative of the statewide referendum vote or ballot measure vote in Ohio on this issue. I think people right now are either zero or for abortion. There is nothing in between this argument over 15 or 22 or is viability 22 or 24. And what is this 15 number? And then some people are at six and I don't think any of it matters right now to voters. I think it's zero or all. And so I think right now we're just fighting on the wrong playing field personally.
But the Republican Party is cornered on this, right? Because it's true, the general electorate and the swing voters, it's yes or no. But you do have the party activists who are so important in the nomination battle. And they have very strong, intense views, and they'll act on them. So is it really even feasible for a Republican candidate to try to fluff up that issue and dodge it or kind of just avoid specific comments?
I think that there's still such a thing as being a pro-life candidate. I think you're still going to see that. I think that litigating and getting into the weeds and litigating the number of weeks, I think is not the right place to be. I think that, you know, making it known that you're not going to go out there and lead, you know, necessarily and try to change things on this issue right now is probably where most candidates are going to need to be. And I think you're going to see the national movement, you know, have to make some changes. And I think that they are. So, I mean, I'm not saying that there's no longer going to be a pro-life movement. There is and there should be. But I think that we just have to figure out how to not litigate, you know, in the weeds where we are right now on the issue.
Ms. Piercy, I want to ask you about two theories I'm hearing in the hours since polls closed yesterday. One is that it's time for Democrats to chill out. There was kind of a freak out over the poll from the New York Times, Siena, yeah. In the last week that showed Biden behind in six battleground states. And the result now is take a deep breath. You know, here you had the incumbent governor, Beshear, in Kentucky, who withstood a whole lot of Republican money and efforts to tie him to Biden. And so that's the more optimistic take. The other take is Biden wasn't on the ballot. And he has all the problems that have been talked about, his age, his the tendency of voters to blame him for inflation and other things related to the economy, and that the Trump forces are still there ready to mobilize around Trump. He wasn't on the ballot either. So are you more, which side do you fall on? Do you think the results are actually hopeful for Democrats or not?
Yes, but I would actually say that I am both on these, because while last night was encouraging for Democrats, despite Biden not being on the ballot, yeah, you're right. We do have to calm down, and we can't let six polls in battleground states spin everybody up and start questioning the president's record and his legitimacy as a candidate. Like, look, it's no secret how old Joe Biden is. We elected him 3 years ago. This is what we knew we were getting into. I think part of the hand-wringing is also just the fear of what another Trump presidency could do to America. And how does that, what happens to the democracy if that actually happens? And so, like, when Kirsten told us she was working for Haley, I was like, great, I have faith in the system again. Like, I can deal with this. But I also think it's a time for Democrats to be introspective and think about what worked last night and what did not work last night. So let's look at the Brandon Presley race in Mississippi and figure out, like, is it worth it to invest in races like that? Or do we need to go elsewhere and think about places like Pennsylvania, where we also picked up a Supreme Court seat, Virginia, where we picked up both the House and the Senate? These are places where we can make really big policy inroads, but I don't know that it necessarily translates to electoral votes, because these are not places we're going to necessarily play for in 2024.
Ms. Kukowski, this poll that came out by the Times at Siena in the past week, it read like a dream come true for Republicans. It found that Trump was leading in five of the six most important battleground states. Biden was getting hurt badly because of reactions to his age and what it meant in terms of his leadership ability. A lot of dissatisfaction with handling the economy. We saw unbelievable erosion, actually, in the what had been a multiracial, multigenerational coalition. I was amazed to see support for Donald Trump among Blacks rise from 6% in 2020 up to 22%. I mean, that is just a stunning result. Do you see that as setting the basic framework heading towards 2024, that the landscape, the environment is fundamentally positive for Republicans?
You know, it's funny. I'm kind of feeling the same as Rebecca in a lot of ways. I felt reading that poll that it was good news. There were good things to learn from it. I do think that it's probably overplayed a little bit. I think that I'm kind of surprised that neither of you talked about crosstabs. I've had a lot of people dive in and say there's maybe some oversampling, maybe some undersampling, maybe some problems with the underlying poll. So I think that those numbers are exact. Do I think that he's winning by that much? No, I don't believe that. Do I believe that it shows that President Biden is in trouble? Yes, I do. I think that there was an assumption several months ago that in a rematch between Biden and Trump, there is no way that former President Trump could win again. And I think that sitting here today, it is very real that he could. And I think that has impacted the GOP primary race, right? So if you're Nikki Haley and your argument is that President Trump can't beat Joe Biden, then that poll wasn't the best, right? So there are some mixed reviews. I will say, you know, for my Nikki Haley clients, some of the statewide races, if you look at those states that they picked, every single one of them is a U.S. Senate race, except one, in the next year. And I think if you're, you're running for U.S. Senate in Nevada or Pennsylvania, Arizona, I think that that's where that polling is very, very indicative of, you know, those chances of the Republicans taking back the Senate.
Ms. Pierce, how do you explain what has been now consistent polling that shows erosion for Democrats, particularly Biden, among people of color? I mean, this poll, you could quibble about the magnitude of it or among Hispanics, but we're seeing it again and again and again. And we saw some of it in recent elections, too. What's going on? Why are Hispanics and Blacks kind of fading away, pulling away from the Democratic Party?
So that is like the $1 million question. And I will answer Kirsten about the crosstabs. Like, nobody has time to dig into the crosstabs if everybody you know is freaking out and getting on Twitter and saying Biden should drop out, right? Like, nobody's looking at the crosstabs. We're doing damage control over here. I think that there's just a natural erosion when you've got a president and you don't feel like things are going necessarily well. And I think that is part of the Biden problem, is in the naming and the branding of Bidenomics. Like, what is that? What does that mean? How are we not just telling people exactly what they're getting, which is what he did in the first year of his administration, which was checks in your pockets, shots in your arms. We're back on track, right? And if it was that simple, I think that we'd have a clearer path to, okay, things are fine. He is old, but things are fine. And we can do this again. I just don't think the messaging is as simple as it could and should be. And that is the thing that I think Democrats need to get their crap together on and figure out in the coming months before ballots start to be cast in some of these states, particularly in primaries. Like, I want to make sure that he does well in these primaries where Dean Phillips is on the ballot, right? And like, we can't take that for granted, because I think that, you know, there is room for people to say, like, okay, is this what we're doing? the time is short, but I do think that there's still a small window.
David Axelrod, Obama's campaign chief, has been getting a lot of headlines for suggesting Biden maybe should step down. That's not going to happen. But he also said some other things, and it was kind of along the lines of what your comments about the messaging. Axelrod said, stop with the bragging about what you've done. We get it that you feel like you're not getting credit for your accomplishments, but it's time to switch gears and focus on the country and the consequence of a potential Trump candidacy. Is that the move that the White House needs to do to kind of reverse some of these poll results?
You know, I don't know that I would necessarily focus the administration or even the campaign side on reversing these poll results, because they're just one poll. And I think what they need to start paying attention to is what happened last night. What are we gleaning from that? What are we learning about voter behaviors in states that look like Kentucky or that look like Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, places where we know they're going to be battleground states and where we know both sides are going to play? And I think that's what can help turn those poll numbers around. I don't necessarily think it's as simple as throwing Trump in the face of the American people and saying it's this or that. Because at the same time we are making that comparison, you've got an entire Republican primary happening and you've got an entire Trump trial happening. And so aside from everything that's going on outside of the US, so I just don't know that focusing us in on just against Trump is going to be enough to put us over the finish line in November next year.
Okay, that's a Democratic perspective. Ms. Kotowski, you're in the thick of the Republican nomination battle, and it's all about Trump to some extent, whether he's on the stage or he's in the courtroom or you're looking at the candidates tonight in the debate. What do you see as the state of play in the battle for the Republican nomination when Donald Trump is up by 40 or 50 points?
Yeah, it's interesting. We have not in recent memory had this situation where you essentially have two parallel tracks moving at the same time. You have Donald Trump and whatever he's doing over here, and then you have the rest of the field over here, and they really don't overlap very often. And it is unprecedented. But I think that there's a few things, that play into Donald Trump in his lead right now. One is the coverage of his lead is that he's essentially the presumptive nominee. And I think that the closer we get to Iowa, that may or may not change. We have time. There's a lot of time, and time isn't just number of days. It's also the time for voters to get into the actual mode of, oh, there's an election. And I think that right now you have the holidays in front of us. And once the holidays are over, I think there's going to be a very, very aggressive pivot toward, oh my gosh, this is an election year. And so I think that timing is going to really impact things. I think we're now moving into the next phase of this, the presidential primary, where you have, all of the other candidates, where a lot of people strategically have been making decisions not to engage Donald Trump, because we've learned some lessons from the previous primary where that didn't necessarily go over so well. And so they're all positioning to be that person to end up taking on Donald Trump. Well, that's getting pretty close. We're almost to who is that person who's going to take on Donald Trump. And then you get into taking on Donald Trump. So that naturally will shift things as well, right? And then I'll bring you back to that parallel track that is moving, which is, we all saw Donald Trump fighting with a judge in a New York courtroom this week. That is crazy. I don't think it was a good look for him. I think that we're seeing in a lot of polling now, public and our internal polling, showing that if and when there is a conviction and on any of these trials, that changes voters' intentions with Donald Trump. And so I think that plays into the primary, but that also plays into kind of what Rebecca's saying, which is that's going to impact the general election and how people, factor in that choice between Biden and Donald Trump. So there's a lot going on right now that we've never, frankly, never seen before. But I truly believe that this is really, in a lot of ways, a jump ball in terms of who the nominee is. And I know that sounds crazy when you see these, you know, polls showing that he's 40, 50 points up, but I truly believe that the numbers are softer than we think that they are. And I'm, you know, waiting for that January 15 start to this so that we can start seeing what the voters are going to do.
Yeah, actually, in the New York Times Siena poll, they probed this very question. They found the conviction in these battleground states reduced Trump's support by about 6 percentage points on average. Now, that is a general election framework. In the nomination battle in the Republican Party, it could be quite different. It appears that, you know, voters are following this. This is not like one of those things that's off the stage. There seems to be a level of interest. Are you in your role working with the Haley campaign, are you tracking voter interests and how much attention and importance they're placing on these various legal actions?
Yeah. I mean, we're tracking just about everything, right? How you're getting your news and who's your second choice? Who's your third choice? You know, what are you having for dinner? But yes, I mean, all of that is very relevant. But it's also outside of our control. And so it's just one of those things where, you know, you got to keep your head down and you have to play your game, and you're going to kind of just, you know, see where everything else kind of, where it all settles as we get into Iowa. And I will say too, one of the other dynamics that I think some people forget, and we really lived this probably the last time in the 2012 cycle, which is Iowa voters, for as engaged as they are, they make decisions really, really late. And so we don't know what that electorate is going to do, and what is a win for Trump. So if he's gone the last year being 40, 50 points up and he only wins by 20, is that a win? I don't know. And then what does that do between, you know, the Iowa caucus and then the New Hampshire primary? And his numbers in New Hampshire are very, very soft. And so, you know, there's a lot more that goes into this presidential early map that people forget about, and the national polling has nothing to do with it.
Yeah. So folks, if you're following this, that is a talking point right there from Ms. Kukowski. Whatever Trump wins in Ohio, if he wins, it's going to be the expectations game. Did he come in under expectations, which is often the way in which the media will cover a story, disappointing results, those kind of headlines. So it's already started.
I will also be using those talking points.
Thank you. Ms. Pearson, let me ask you, what is your kind of read on the Trump legal part? There's been some chatter that the Trump is used in courtrooms as a way to campaign. And so, you know, his outburst this week was really aimed at the voters who saw him acting out. And not helpful at all in the courtroom. But what do you see as the possible consequences? Is this going to matter?
I don't know that it actually matters. I feel like, and I've said this in this group before, like I feel like the Republican Party is so split between the everybody else and the Trump people. He is playing to those Trump people that are like Trump only, right? And no matter what the consequences legally or in the courtroom, because there's no such thing as bad press to him and that whatever section of the Republican Party. And I think that, you know, even if he does get convicted, I'm happy to hear that his numbers do go down with convictions, because I think that's good for America and good for democracy. Never mind, you know, my politics or Kristen's politics. But I also am still... I still don't understand the people that are super loyal to him, and I don't think I ever will. And to me, it's just a real problem. Like, how do those people come back into the system? How do they come back into being voters? How do they get back into the Republican Party? Where do they go? Are they libertarians? Are they independents? Is it just like the Trump Party now? And so I do think that, you know, part of the bravado around everything in the trial right now is for those people to keep them top of mind, or for them to keep him top of mind, but also like that's his shtick. He was gonna never surrender, and then he surrendered, and now he's on t-shirts saying never surrender with his mugshot. right? It's just like, it's the insane stuff like this that you're like, what, how are we doing this? Like, who are these people, and how do we reengage, and at what point do they snap out of it, or do they?
Yeah. Well, that's a huge question, and one that a lot of us are thinking about. You can see in the House of Representatives, you've got this real-time split in the Republican Party, and there's a large influential faction now that's emerged that's very much tied into the kind of angry, resentful populism that Donald Trump has really pushed forward. Ms. Kakowski, you're working with Nikki Haley. She seems to be surging. The poll numbers in New Hampshire, she went from a few points, she's now 20 points in some polling. You know, Governor DeSantis looks like he's losing altitude fast and can't find his own speed. Is Nikki Haley resting too soon? Is this something that's building, or is this kind of one of those times where you see a candidate kind of surge because of a good debate performance and some good poll numbers and slide back?
I mean, I feel like this has been a conversation about her surging for a couple months now. I mean, this is now the third debate that we're going to be waiting to see how this goes. There's been one debate each month. And so, you know, I think that she's proven that there's staying power. It isn't just a one debate bump and then, you know, her polls slide, you know, or go up a little bit and then she starts sliding. So to me, it feels like she has the staying power. I don't think it's too early. I actually think it's probably pretty good timing. But she has to keep capitalizing on it, right? So I think today, you know, I'm here, I am in Miami, and we're all hopeful that she has another good debate. But frankly, more of the pressure, right, you know, today is on Governor DeSantis. I mean, they have been very clear through this entire primary that that his only argument was he was the only one that could take on Trump and win. And he hasn't even gotten there yet. And here we are in November. So I think she has staying power. I think that based on what I'm seeing, you know, here on the ground at the debate and just, you know, listening to reporters, people are taking it seriously. And you know, the other thing too, that I think I was kind of alluding to this too before, is early state presidential politics these national polls don't matter. This is, do you have a path in each of these early states? And Nikki has a path in Iowa. She has a path in New Hampshire, and she definitely has a path in South Carolina. Ron has put kind of all of his eggs in one basket in Iowa, and a lot in Chris Christie in New Hampshire, et cetera. And so, you know, you start breaking the map down that way. And that's why I think, you know, where Nikki definitely has the staying power, because she has the paths in the early states that others just don't have.
She almost alone among the candidates has put an emphasis on foreign policy. How does the crisis in the Middle East play to her? Is this something that's an advantage that she's going to dive into that can help her at a time when Americans seem, particularly Republicans, seem to be turning inward?
Yeah, it's interesting. She started this foreign policy, you know, before really the Ukraine Russia conflict was happening, and she engaged on that. And then all of a sudden you have Israel. And so it is definitely right in her strength. And so in some ways, you know, yeah, this is it was all very good timing for her, unfortunately, for the world and for the, you know, the conflict in Israel and Palestinian territory. But it's just I think it has allowed her to demonstrate her strengths in a long sustained fashion. And it is interesting. It's there is definitely a divide in the party over, you know, how hawkish should we be. But she's demonstrated that, I mean, everyone knows she's wearing it on her sleeve. Like, she feels very strongly. And every time another candidate, whether it's Ron DeSantis or, you know, Vivek Ramaswamy, they have been the ones that have come at it from kind of that, inner nationalist, perspective, and they've lost every single time. So, you know, we'll see. I think it'll be a big issue tonight.
Ms. Piercy, how do you see foreign policy playing out? I mean, it's in Democratic circles, of course, there's almost a civil war going on about Israel and Gaza and the Palestinians. Is that something that's going to have a lasting effect, or is it just kind of this week's news?
You know, it's interesting. I've seen some polling, and I think, you know, if my clients were smart and other Democrats were smart, they would make sure that this is in every poll to figure out how are we going to navigate this as a party? Because I do think it is very, very split. And it's almost like a generational divide as well. It's not just a very liberal thing and a very conservative thing. It's really the 40 and under is for a ceasefire. 40 plus is, you know, sort of let's let Israel keep doing what they're doing and, you know, figure out what to do with Hamas when we find them, which is interesting. And I haven't seen anything like this in polling in my time in politics, but we also haven't seen anything this where we've been this involved since, I think, the Iraq war. I do think it's going to continue to be an issue. And I think it's going to become an issue really quickly once we start getting into some of these congressional primaries. So look at the March 5th races. So you've got Pennsylvania, California, I think Texas, some of these places where you've got the squad members who are up and they're against some AIPAC-backed Democrats. And you're going to see some losses from some of those more liberal candidates there.
That's pretty important. Thank you for that. We've got a lot of questions that are coming in. I wanted to get to a few. Have either of you tracked how candidates did last night who were endorsed by Donald Trump?
I have not done the actual, like, you know, candidate by candidate. I would say that narrative wise, it definitely feels like it was a loss for Trump's brand. And I know that there are several of his opponents, Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley, both kind of came out with that narrative this morning, but I have not done that math myself. So I'm not going to sound very intelligent. Rebecca, I don't know if you have.
Oh, just Kentucky, only in Kentucky where he endorsed the guy and then said, I didn't endorse that guy. So
classic.
Yeah.
Ms. Kukowski, has a question here for you, asking you to explain the devolution of the Republican Party into authoritarianism and the strong leader in the form of Donald Trump. How's that happen, and how do you get out of it?
That's a really good question. How did we get there? I don't know. And I think this is one of the things that historically is going to, we're going to look back on. And I feel like, you know, there's all these things that we are going to look back and say, Donald Trump was an anomaly. Donald Trump create, you know, it was more about his persona that took over and created these realities within the party and within, you know, government. Because before Donald Trump, we were the party who was against Barack Obama's executive orders. And, you know, what we thought was the executive order or executive office overreach. And so, I don't have a very good answer. I think that this is going to come down to Donald Trump and his persona more than it is about what the Republican Party's principles were at the time. If that makes sense. I don't know that anyone else outside of Donald Trump would have done what he, you know, would have acted in that way in the White House.
Ms. Piercy, here's a question. I'm sure you hear this a lot. It's basically, why is Joe Biden having so much trouble when the economy is strong, unemployment is low, inflation is coming down, you know, a bunch of legislative wins? What's your answer for that frustrated Democrat?
I don't know. And I was speaking at another group last night, and I thought about this morning too. Part of it, and I don't want to be like the old lady that's going to blame social media, but I think part of this is like, there's so much social media narrative out there where it's like, okay, here's how much this grocery haul cost in 2016. Here's how much it cost in 2019. Here's how much it cost again in 2023. And the prices keep going up. But it's also something that, like, we've never seen TikTok do that before. It's just in the back of all of our minds, right? And it's just something that's there. And before, when prices would go up, we would just all kind of bitch about it and it would be amongst our friends. So I think that maybe it's just that it's more pervasive in front of mind, top of mind for us as we go about our days, as we're on Instagram and TikTok and Twitter and like on the news, but also, you know, maybe he's not doing a great job of being a messenger. And that is a mess, right? And I think that is the part that needs to get figured out really quickly before real campaigning starts, particularly as Republicans start coming out of these primaries and we have more clarity into what the general election is going to look like. But I do think, you know, outside groups, aside from like Joe Biden and the Biden campaign, are doing a really good job talking about the legislative wins, talking about the gubernatorial victories last night, and talking about some of the abortion ballot initiatives that have been on the ballot over the last year and a half, 2 years, in six states. And so other people are doing a great job talking about it. I think Joe Biden is not doing a great job talking about it. And that's where the disconnect is to me.
You know, I would just weigh in here real quick. I mean, just from, for what it's worth, from the Republican perspective, it's interesting hearing Rebecca. I believe that it's interest rates, plain and simple. It is really? Interest rates that people feel when they look at their credit card statement, when they want to open, they want a new line of credit and they can't get it, when they're looking at their you know, mortgage statements and, or they're trying to get a new house or they want to get out of their house, but they can't afford to because interest rates are now, you know, through the roof. I think that we had been so used to very, very, very low interest rates and they have gone up. And I think people feel that and see that in a real way. I just had this issue come up on one of my media training sessions earlier today about this phenomenon of cities and states, mostly cities, not knowing how to zone tiny houses that have become all the rage because people cannot afford housing. And cities don't know how to tax and zone tiny houses. And so now there's a movement against tiny house developments. So anyway, I bring that up because I think it's.
Did we lose her?
Maybe we did. Okay, thank you. We lost you there for a second. It's good to have you back though.
Sorry.
It's okay.
We're talking about tiny houses.
If you've got other tabs open, if you close them, it might help.
I have none. No. Hotel, I apologize. Hotel internet.
Yeah. Ms. Piercy, let me ask you about third parties. You've got Kennedy is obviously in it. I don't know if he's got much traction, but I think it's more no labels being in the race that's got people concerned. What's your level of anxiety that you might have a kind of a third party candidate who draws from just, I don't know, kind of disaffected independents, maybe soft Democrats, and pull up, you know, 2-3%, just enough to tilt some of these battleground states towards the Republican?
My anxiety level on it is almost none. I just feel like a third party candidate in this instance, and in this, assuming we are running against Trump in this time of like, we are going one way or we are going another way. If it's Nikki Haley, it's like, we're just going this way, right? Like, we're not, democracy's not on fire. I just don't know why a third party candidate would get in this race and really throw things out of whack one way or another. I think it's really delusional at this point to think that a third party could inject themselves into a race and into the conversation that we're having and be successful. So I do think it's a spoiler. And I also think it's really hard to get on the ballot in a lot of these places. And I think that we're running out of time.
So Ms. Kukowski, as you know, because you live in Minnesota, Liz Cheney was here not long ago. And she made the comment that she might consider running as an independent candidate for president if Trump is nominated. Is that feasible? Could she get on the ballot that quickly after the party convention? And if so, do you think there would be kind of no Trump Republicans who might vote for her enough to tilt elections?
No, I don't think it's feasible at all. Getting on ballots is way harder than people think. I agree with Rebecca, even on our campaign. We have, you know, we have the infrastructure and have had it for years, with her, you know, that PAC and everything, and ballot access for a candidate like Nikki is hard. So imagine then, you know, trying to do it as an independent where there is not the infrastructure that you have in the two-party system. So no, I don't believe it's feasible.
We haven't talked about congressional elections. There's been a lot happening in the U.S. House of Representatives, with Republicans kind of playing duck, duck, goose in terms of who's going to be speaker, and then factions within the House Republican caucus, you know, in full display. Does all that intramural stuff really going to matter a year from now when we get to congressional elections?
I think so. One, who wants to come to Congress and be part of that? Two, it was not duck, duck, goose. It was hot potato. Three, it is just so dysfunctional. And I don't actually think that I don't see this speaker lasting until November. And I think it has implications on the campaign arm because he is the one driving the Republicans' agenda. So they've got to run on that agenda. And Mike Johnson has no idea what he's doing. So that, I think, is where the problem is. And it's the opportunity for Democrats, but it's also like America's loss. So that's the concern with like the chaos in the House over the last month or so. It's fun to watch C-SPAN if you're a nerd like us, but like it's not great if you are trying to fund the government, make sure Social Security checks go out, et cetera.
So just to be a little more concrete, your comment about Speaker Johnson is that he's now put forward an agenda in which kind of the hard right policies are being voted on. They're being passed. So you've got a lot of voters in districts that Biden would have won that are going to be competitive being forced to take votes to these things.
Yeah.
And Democrats are going to, you know, obviously eat that up and use it in campaign ads come a year's time. Is that your concern or kind of critique of just the quality of the leadership he's providing?
I mean, it's my hope, Larry. It's my hope that that's the leadership he's providing. I mean, that's honestly what I think is happening now and what will continue to happen. And I mean, we've still got the looming shutdown on, what is it, the 17th?
That that's going to be, you know, the part of voters' minds, or is it really going to be the usual presidential campaign mattering?
I think this, especially in a presidential cycle, it'll be nationalized. I think that it's a year out. It can't happen again, right? We can't go through this again in a few months, and we have to keep the government funded. And so I think that those two things are big ifs. But I think there's a lot of incentive right now after having just gone through what we went through on the Republican side to make sure it doesn't happen again. And I think there's also a lot of incentive on both sides of the aisle to not let the government shut down because it doesn't benefit either party. And both parties get blamed and we're heading into an election cycle. So no one's wanting the government shut down as we're going into the Iowa caucuses. And that's the timing that it would be. It sounds like they're going to likely pass something that will get us out of this 17th deadline, but that it will back it up to basically right after the new year, which would essentially be the Iowa caucuses. And let me tell you, there's going to be a lot of pressure to not do that.
And when they pass something, is this going to be something that the Democratic-controlled Senate would pass and that President Biden would sign? Because so far, what we're seeing publicly, it's dead on arrival. It's just not going to go anywhere.
Right. I mean, it feels like there's latitude being given to him, to the new speaker, to make a deal to not shut the government down. I know it doesn't look like that publicly, but that is my take behind the scenes. So we'll see. But you know, this does get muddier for the new speaker and for the Republican caucus as we inch closer to that presidential election, for sure.
Both of you follow what are known as special elections. This is when you've got a member of the House of Representatives who, for whatever reason, steps down or dies in office. And geeks like me, and maybe geeks like you, track how they do compared to the expected results determined by party strength in the districts. And there's been a pattern which Democrats have been overperforming, again, based on the party makeup of the districts. Is that something, Rebecca Pearcey, you take confidence in, that actually on the ground, Democrats are doing better than you might expect in these House races?
Sometimes I'm genuinely surprised that we do as well as we do. I mean it, like, you know, because I've been doing this long enough to understand conventional wisdom and how these things are supposed to go, right? And so I'm genuinely surprised that we do as well as we do, particularly in this environment with Biden as unpopular as he is. So yeah, I take, you know, I'm excited about it. Confidence? No, because I think the other shoe's going to drop at some point and we go back to either, I believe that we just go back to the conventional wisdom and it's back to whatever we thought the district was going to do, the district is going to do. The one thing I will say that is interesting about last night's results, but also what will be interesting about any specials that we have coming up, new lines, right? We're running on really new lines. We ran on new lines in Virginia last night for the first time. And so that is what made the results so interesting. I think that there was the thought that Democrats would do well. I don't think that I thought that we would take back the House and the Senate. But again, when you're running on new lines, all you can do is go on the data and sort of the math and not necessarily the entire feel of simulating a live campaign and having it play out with people actually casting their ballots.
When you talk about new lines, are you talking about redistricting?
Redistricting, yeah, redistricted lines.
Yeah, and that's kind of interesting because in 2022, Democrats probably did better than some people thought. In the last year or so, it looks like Republicans have been doing better in general on the redistricting. And Ms. Kukowski, does that give you a little more confidence about how Republicans will do in House races? That you're shaking your head no.
No, actually, I one of the things, narratives that coming out of Virginia is actually that the redistricting didn't help Republicans, and that was part of the reason why there were losses there. So it's state by state, to be honest. It's how the individual lines were drawn. And so no, it doesn't give me any confidence. If anything, I think it probably gives me more pause. But I also just, you know, into the larger question about special elections, you know, it kind of feels kind of similar to what the, you know, the elections were last night, which is if Democrats can make it about a single issue and the issue is, you know, what it's been for the last several years, then, you know, then yeah, we're Republicans are not going to do well in specials or in, you know, non-presidential or non-midterm years.
Ms. Pearcey, there's been kind of a pretty steady pessimism about the Democrats' ability to hold the Senate. There are a number of races, at least five, in Ohio and West Virginia with Manchin, but also Nevada, Arizona, and Montana, of course, with Tester, where you've got Democrats running in pretty hard Republican states now where Trump did well. Are you prepared for the Democrats to lose the majority in the Senate? Does that seem like a real possibility?
Prepared, yes. Do I think it'll happen? Only maybe. And here's why. I think what Democrats need to really do, and think about those states you just listed, and you know, there's only a little bit of over, there's no, only Arizona, Nevada overlap with what would be considered a true battleground state where Biden and the eventual Republican nominee will contend. I think the lesson from last night for Democrats is truly Kentucky. And how do you let a candidate be that candidate, run on their record, not be afraid to either be tied or disassociate from the national party, whatever makes the most sense. And I think that the thing to remember, particularly about Ohio, Nevada, Montana, West Virginia, they're all battle tested. They've won there before. The other thing I would say is, like, I don't think of Ohio as a swing state anymore. I think last night proved it can be won by progressive causes. I think it's a Sherrod Brown state. And if this was not Sherrod Brown up for re-election, I would say that Ohio was gone. But I think with Sherrod leading the top of the ticket there, no matter if it's, you know, Trump or whoever else, I think that one stays in our column. So I actually feel cautiously optimistic about holding the Senate. And it's not like I take a lot of joy in saying, like, let's go do this in Arizona and West Virginia, because they all, like, that's hard, right? This is not a favorable map for Democrats at this point.
Yeah, Ms. Kukowski, does that map look to you like high probability of a Republican pickup in terms of the majority?
Yeah, I mean, I feel pretty good about it. I think I look at that, like I said before, that the New York Times Senate poll, I think, you know, most of those states are Senate seats, but I mean, you always have to be cautious. And I do believe that there will likely be split chambers, right? So I don't know if it's that the Democrats pick up the House and we flip and we take the Senate. I Americans like split government, especially when they're not going to be super keen on either, you know, if it is Biden-Trump rematch, you know, they're not going to be super keen on either one of them, right? So then they're going to go down to the next two chambers and they're likely going to have split government, is my take. But in terms of the Senate map, I mean, I think that that's where the Biden and the inflation and the interest rates that I was talking about before, I think, are going to definitely impact states like Nevada, states like Arizona, and Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. That, you know, the poll obviously was a little mixed on Wisconsin, but I definitely think it's going to be a battleground. And you know, that she's obviously very solid, but I think that there's going to be some she's going to have some real national headwinds in Wisconsin in a presidential year. And that, you know, I look at the West Virginia race, and Joe Manchin just doesn't seem like somebody who wants to be in the United States Senate anymore. He just doesn't feel like somebody who's really energized and enthused to be a senator. So, you know, if he's not in the mix, then it's for sure a pickup on our end. So it'll be interesting to watch.
Do you feel like the conditions related to Biden's unpopularity and the way in which inflation has sunk into the consciousness of Americans, is that kind of a set piece for the political environment over the next year? I mean, there's some things you can change and will vary, but just the basic backdrop, we're looking at unpopular incumbent, inflation really nagging at people and dragging down their well-being. Is that, that's kind of a baked in already?
I don't think it feels, I mean, we might disagree. Right. You go first.
No. Well, I just think like there is so much that could change in a year. I don't think a year ago we would have thought that we would be where we are as Democrats polling wise. I don't think that we thought we would be where we were with Trump, where he is. And I don't know necessarily that we would have seen like the sort of economic headwinds coming at us as Democrats and as an administration either. So it's hard to say, like, is something that baked in? Maybe something will happen tomorrow and it'll all go away, right? Like, I don't know.
I mean, I agree that it's, we don't know. I think that the question mark I really have about specifically the interest rates is President Biden doesn't have much control over that, if any. And that's, I think, that would be the scary thing for me if I'm working on his reelect or I'm working in these U.S. Senate races on the Dem side is, you know, what the Fed decides to do and when is not in your control. And that is what people are feeling and seeing on a daily basis.
And the Fed's made it really clear they're not making any sudden decisions on interest rates, even if the economy weakens a bit. Question on Kamala Harris, who keeps getting a lot of attention. Front page stories seem to be about every month on her. Is she a positive or a negative, Ms. Piercy, for Democrats, or doesn't she matter in terms of the presidential election?
I mean, I think she's a net positive, but I also don't think that vice presidents really matter when it comes to your electoral politics. Like, I don't think Mike Pence had an impact on the 2020 race. Am I excited it's a Black woman? Yeah, but I mean, I think it's still a net positive, but like it's a slight net positive because I still don't think they really matter.
Ms. Kukowski, I've heard some Republicans say that they think Kamala Harris is a good target. And the reasoning behind that is Joe Biden is old. And so then you just play that out. Who would be next in line if Joe Biden became incapacitated, it would be Kamala Harris. And what do you think of her?
Yeah, you just played out exactly what is being, you know, thrown around every GOP meeting right now. I mean, that is exactly what is being said. I don't Personally, I don't get the whole Kamala Harris, you know, as a foil thing. I agree with Rebecca. I feel like top of the ticket, you know, president's going to is what we should be focused on. But from a grassroots, Republican base standpoint, they absolutely are focused on Kamala. And I do think that that's a big motivator, if nothing else.
Ms. Piercy, we just held a conference here last week on Article 14, Section 3, which is being litigated in a bunch of states and will become more and more prevalent. And this is the never used before, rarely discussed provision that is being pulled forward to say that a president who has participated in or provided support for insurrection should be disqualified. There's lots of legal arguments around this, but I'm curious, are you tracking this? And do you think this is a direction that you'd encourage Democrats and Republicans to pursue?
Well, I'm tracking it, but again, it's because we're nerds. But how great is it that there was a piece of the Constitution nobody had ever had to think about before January 6th of 2021, right? And so, yeah, but I don't think it's something that like the everyday voter is going to be like, but Article 3, right? Like, there's just no, people are worried about putting food on their table and gas in their cars. This is not a kitchen table issue to people. I think it is something for scholars, for constitutional lawyers. And I think that there's still debate everywhere about whether or not this is like a real thing that we can pin him on. And if it's not, then we've certainly got 91 other charges at this point, but is that enough? I don't know.
Ms. Kapowski, I'm curious about the possibility that you could have the leading Republican presidential candidate disqualified through the courts. And, you know, the arguments could be profound and well justified, but can the legitimacy of American democracy withstand a situation where you've got such a powerful, popular candidate pulled off?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's unprecedented. I think that it probably will succeed in a state. It probably will succeed at least somewhere. I think that ultimately what that will do, which is, I think is bad for my party and democracy, is it will take people who would normally not be Trump supporters, and they will go in his camp only because they believe that the government was clearly out to get him. And that is not the role of our government, because we are a representative democracy and we do not do that. And I hear that all the time from very, very smart people who are, you know, center right, but not Trumpers. And I think we should all be very careful with him, you know, obviously, as a current candidate.
And you have some recollection of Scott Walker's situation in Wisconsin, where there was an effort to move against him on constitutional grounds, and that backfired and helped to reelect him when he ran. So I take it you're taking all that into account.
And made him a presidential candidate, and yes, definitely. So there is a way to make a career and make a candidate for a lot of years if you aren't careful. I think we need to be careful in this one.
We've run out of time, and I want to share the comments of Carol Buffton, who said, I want to thank both panelists. So appreciate your candor, wisdom, and clear respect for each other. Thank you. And I want to just second that. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is one of my favorite things to do. So thank you. I just want to make a few closing comments. Next Tuesday, November 14th at 11 Central Time, we're going to have a tremendous program. It's going to be a discussion of What's Next for American Democracy, which is a report that's come out with the journal Democracy: A Journal of Ideas. And it's going to feature all stars in the academic world who've been really studying this. Theda Scotchbowl from Harvard, Chloe Thurston from Northwestern, and Princeton's Keith Whittington. Please join us. I think that's going to be extraordinary. There's been a lot of attention to unions, some big wins recently, and yet there's been a decline in the share of workers who are unionized. Why isn't unionization growing? We've got a great panel. Minnesota AFL-CIO President Bernie Burnham will be with us. University of Minnesota Law School Professor Charlotte Garden and Kathy McGarry, who's at the Metropolitan Airports Commission. And the program will be moderated by History Professor Will Jones. And that is November 15th at 12 Central Time. Two great programs. We've got a whole lot coming up after that, too. Want to let you know, if you've enjoyed this program, and thank you for the good comments on those count. There will be a video recording of this, and there will be a podcast available. So please check that out. Give us a day or two to get that up. If you've enjoyed this program, please consider making a donation. Excellent way to make your end of the year contributions. All of our events are free, open to the public, and we rely on donor support to keep up this work. So consider joining our donor circle. So let me again thank you. Send out thanks to Rebecca Piercy and Kirsten Kukowski. You two are awesome. Thank you so much, and good luck with each of your enterprises.
Thanks.
Take care. And thanks to all of you for joining us.